Hello, this time on SITREP, who should the Prime Minister rely on when taking decisions about our national security? One of Britain's top generals was about to become the first national security advisor from the forces, but Keir Starmer has decided to re-advertise the post. So, what kind of person could he be looking for? And would military experience make any difference? Lord Peter Ricketts, who was the UK's first national security advisor, joins us to explain all about the job. Also on SITREP.
We didn't realise that we were, you know, doing anything tremendous. We were, you know, we were enjoying our flying. We were enjoying showing our team to the country.
We remember Henry Prince, a pioneer of the Red Arrows, and there's some crazy flying to talk about. And the surprising moment that made Andy McNab, former SAS soldier, holder of the Distinguished Conduct Medal and international best-selling author.
None of that would have happened unless I'd sat in that classroom with the world's oldest soldier coming in and just explaining the facts of life and getting in the grip of us, basically.
SITREP with Kate Chabot.
So, Mike is away this week, but the good news is that Professor Peter Roberts is with us once again. He's a senior fellow at the University of Exeter's Centre for Public Understanding of Defence and Security. He's also former Director of Military Sciences at RUSI and a former Royal Navy officer, and the list goes on. Good to see you, Peter. Thanks. Welcome back to SITREP. Last time we were together, it was May, and since then, we've got a new government, a defence review is underway, a new Chief of General Staff leading the Army. A lot's happened in 3 months, hasn't it?
Right, it's been really busy, and the world hasn't got any safer, right? Ukraine has made this huge incursion into Russia, unpicking everything that had been talked about transparent battlefields. You've got Israel continuing operations in Gaza while being attacked by Hamas and Hezbollah, and a potential attack from Iran itself on Israel being talked about. No solution to the Houthis in Yemen, who are giving global trade problems. North Korea's continuing nuclear development. China's eyeing Taiwan. The Balkans has underlying tension. Climate change in Africa is producing huge migration flows. I mean, the future looks like compounding all these problems and challenges. And so if we think it's busy now, we just wait for the next 5 years, right?
Indeed. And something else that's changed is the plan for the UK's next national security advisor, a role created in 2010, always held by a civilian civil servant since then. Maybe Keir Starmer wants to keep it that way. It's one explanation being suggested for the decision not to proceed with the appointment of Royal Marines General Gwyn Jenkins into that role. Would military experience matter or make any difference? If anyone can explain all of this, it's Lord Peter Ricketts. He was the UK's first national security advisor. Peter, great to have you on, sir. Always good to speak to you. National security is about more than just military matters. How much of that job is about the work of the armed forces and Ministry of Defence, and how much of it is about civilian security efforts?
Hello, Kate. It's about all the above. Perhaps I can just explain, as I lived it, a national security advisor wore three hats. He is the closest in advisor to the Prime Minister on not just defence but foreign policy, intelligence, security issues, the person the Prime Minister sees first in the morning and last in the evening on those issues. National Security Advisor travels with the Prime Minister on trips, attends meetings the Prime Minister has with visiting statesmen in London. So without coming between ministers and their Prime Minister, there's a crucial advisory role. Secondly, it's the Secretary of the National Security Council, preparing the agendas, making sure the papers are good quality, networking with Whitehall to have a balanced diet of defence issues, but foreign policy, crisis issues as well, and also a kind of honest broker with other members of the National Security Council, make sure they're happy with the arrangements. And then third hat, a member of a global club of national security advisors. So the UK National Security Advisor is the person who gets the 3 a.m. call from the White House, from his US counterpart when there's a crisis, but also has an extensive network of other people playing similar roles. And he therefore travels on his own behalf, perhaps carrying messages from the Prime Minister. So it's a very varied role, and it goes, as you say, well beyond the purely defence issue.
And Peter Roberts, when you look at the jobs of service chiefs, and Gwyn Jenkins was vice chief of the defence staff, their role is pretty immersed in Whitehall and wider government beyond MOD main building, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's never black and white entirely. Whilst, you know, the senior levels, the top levels of the Ministry of Defence do a lot of cross Whitehall work, their responsibilities, some outward facing, some inward facing. There is a lot of discussion with allies, there's a lot of discussion, informal talks, and of course, General Jenkins himself was the military assistant to the Prime Minister for a couple of years, so did a lot of the travelling. But he doesn't have the contact, the network that Lord Ricketts just talked about, and perhaps not exposure to that level of thinking in those ways. So it's not black or white. Yes, they do a lot of work internal, a lot of it is policy work, but they do some of this discussion, most of it, however, being with other military people.
And Peter Ricketts, you came to the job through the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. How well did that equip you for what you needed to understand about military matters? And also, how much military expertise was around you to draw upon?
Yes, I came from a diplomat's perspective, which meant the foreign policy beat was one that I knew very well. I knew the intelligence world well, as because we worked very closely with them. And I actually had quite a lot of experience working with our wonderful armed forces. I was the ambassador to NATO. I was involved in a lot of the crisis work at the Whitehall end, the Iraq intervention, Afghanistan, and so on. So I'd lived with military colleagues a lot over my 20 or 30 years before the job. But I wouldn't have seen myself as competent to advise the Prime Minister on purely military defence issues. And I think there is an issue for the National Security Advisor mustn't get between the Prime Minister and the Chief of the Defence Staff, who is really the Prime Minister's closest military advisor. So that's another interface to be played, if I could say so, diplomatically.
So what proportion of the issues crossing your desk were military or had a military dimension?
Quite a lot of what the National Security Council discussed was the latest crisis. In my day, it was the withdrawal from Afghanistan, it was the Libya campaign, it was Syria and the attack on the chemical weapons dumps. So crisis like that, all very much on the agenda, counter-terrorism work involving special forces, very much part of the National Security Council. But it varied from month to month. Sometimes I tried to get them to take a step back and look at the deeper strategic issues. We were also, of course, deeply engaged in the Strategic Defence and Security Review, which meant some pretty deep and difficult cuts to the defence programme, including the aircraft carriers, 8 years without aircraft carriers till we could get the new ones online. So there was a great deal of defence substance in the National Security Council, but the actual issue varied from week to week.
And Peter Roberts, one point that's been made is that the Chief of the Defence Staff is ultimately supposed to be the Prime Minister's military advisor. If there's another four-star with a direct line to the Prime Minister who could give very different advice, that's potentially a big problem.
It is. And as Lord Ricketts just said, you know, that the job of the National Security Advisor is distinctly different to simply providing military advice. So somehow those two personalities would have to find a way of working. But that's not unheard of. If you turn to Australia, one of their most successful National Security Advisors, Angus Campbell, came out and retired from the Australian Army, got the job through competition as a Deputy National Security Advisor at the time, then got promoted to be National Security Advisor. He was so good at the job and they thought he had such a great strategic mindset, they moved him back in to the military. He rejoined the military and became Chief of Defence Staff. So there are ways of this working. But to me, it's all about the personality who does it. That's the most important point. Peter sort of glossed over it a little bit, but it's about the mental capacity, about the personality, about the EQ, as well as the IQ of the person who does this, about the strategic mindset that really sets a National Security Advisor apart from any of the military or senior advisors across Whitehall.
And of course, Gwyn Jenkins was a Deputy National Security Advisor, Lord Ricketts.
Yes, he was. I mean, I know Gwyn, and I don't really want to get into the personalities of the issue. He's experienced in Whitehall, if you could call him a Whitehall warrior, as well as a fine soldier. I think the mistake actually was by the then Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, in making an appointment of this kind just a few months before a British election was due. As Peter says, the interface, the personality link between the Prime Minister and their National Security Advisor, man or woman, is crucial. And therefore, it's only right that a Prime Minister should get to choose their National Security Advisor in the same way as that Prime Ministers in the end choose a Cabinet Secretary. because they're somebody that they see all the time and they need to feel comfortable with in terms of personality.
So would there be an advantage in having a top military officer as national security advisor at some stage?
I mean, to me, it's all about personality. So it's about finding the right person who interacts with the Prime Minister, who interacts with the rest of the staff, who interacts across Whitehall, with those he's going to see in the White House, across Europe, in Japan, even in China and Russia. It's that person. Now, if that person is a military officer, then great. If they're a civil servant, if they're a diplomat, if, you know, they could come from any realm. It's about that personality and finding the right person with the mental capacity to do all this stuff, to do some of those really, really difficult tasks that Lord Ricketts talked about. You know, this is about an individual rather than just a post, a military officer, a FCO diplomat. You know, it's more than that. It's about the person.
Yes, I agree with that. It's about the person. It's also about experience. I think you have to have somebody who comes to the job with the experience and with the credibility that comes from having, you know, been a major player around the Whitehall scene in one place or another. I wouldn't rule out the idea of a military person at some point. I do think that the point we've been discussing is very important, that there shouldn't be any confusion in the command chain, which goes from the Prime Minister to the Chief of Defence Staff and the Secretary of Defence, and therefore the National Security Advisor has to be very sensitive to that. That's perhaps more tricky if you are a former very senior military officer. I don't see anything's impossible with the right personality, but I think that it's the mix of experience and the personal chemistry between the PM and the National Security Advisor that is the most important.
And Lord Ricketts, while we have you here, can we just take advantage to get some of your insights on a couple of other important matters at the moment? Keir Starmer, just been to Germany, surrounded by talk of a post-Brexit reset with Europe, a bilateral treaty with Berlin, with defence at its heart, is promised. What do you make of that?
Yes, it's very interesting. He is at the stage at the moment of communicating goodwill, good intentions, determination to work closely with our European neighbours. In Germany, there was a lot of stress on that. John Healey, the Defence Secretary, had been there a couple of weeks before and had put out quite a detailed declaration with his German counterpart on defence cooperation, armed forces cooperation, defence industrial cooperation. So that will clearly be part of this proposed UK-German treaty. The Prime Minister then went on to France and had the similar sort of discussion. Of course, we have an existing close defence relationship with France through the Lancaster House treaties, which we negotiated in 2010. And the German-UK defence relationship has not been quite at the same level and the same intensity as the one with France. Of course, France and Britain are nuclear allies, it makes it a bit different. But I welcome the point that we're going to try and bring our UK-German defence cooperation up to the same sort of level as we have with the French. The Germans are major players, of course, in defence industry, a lot of money to spend in reviving the Bundeswehr. Also major NATO allies, big supporters of Ukraine. Lots for the UK and Germany to work on together alongside an existing very positive UK-French defence relationship.
And Peter Roberts, is this militarily significant or more so politically?
I mean, it's certainly politically significant. Militarily, it could become very significant because the forces are really overcommitted at the moment. So if you're going to ask them to do more with Germany, to put it on a par with, for example, the UK-French military cooperation, something else has got to go from the defence commitments. You can't just keep committing overstretched forces to the same thing time and time again. So something's got to give. The key question, maybe for a national security advisor in the future, is what gives? Is it Indo-Pacific military relationships? Is it a partnership with someone else? What's going to give to make this UK-German agreement work properly?
And Lord Ricketts, the other big international factor at the moment is the big question, Trump or Harris. How much does that unknown of who will be the next US president currently complicate the kind of defence and national security decisions the new government's working on?
Well, the new government has talked about a new defence review to come out. I think they talk about early next year. And I suspect the timing of that is not a coincidence, because by then we will know who is in the White House. I think it would be quite hard to publish a defence review a few days before the US election, because it will make a material difference. Of course, we have the defence, strategic, nuclear, intelligence relationship with the Americans, which is so deep and strong that I hope it would survive whoever is in the White House. But if it was a President Trump, I'm afraid he would go back to undermining NATO, pulling back from US support for Europe, including Ukraine. It would pose all kinds of problems for the British and other European governments. If it was a President Harris, that would be different. But President Harris would be also a different generation, not the same transatlantic instinct that President Biden has brought to the job. So it is going to be a different America, whoever is in the White House. To me, that makes the case for stronger cooperation between the European countries. But I definitely think it makes sense to leave our defense review to complete it when we know who is the new occupant of the White House and what the kind of challenges are that we'll have to sustain the very important strategic relationship we've always had with the Americans.
And what about those big appointments, the National Security Advisor or Ambassador to Washington, Lord Ricketts?
Well, I think the National Security Advisor, as I understand it, Keir Starmer is proposing to have a competition in Whitehall. He wants to make clear that he's going through the proper processes, but I guess that will come fairly quickly. Since we are now so close to the American election, it makes sense to leave the current excellent Ambassador Karen Pierce in Washington to see through the election and then to appoint somebody after that. We've all heard talk of possible political appointees. That wouldn't be completely unprecedented. Jim Callahan appointed Peter Jay to Washington in the 1970s. It would be unusual, not impossible. I mean, there often are one or two political appointee ambassadors. Going back to Peter Roberts's point, I mean, the key thing would be to have the right person, whether it's a political appointment, whether it's a senior diplomat or somebody else. It's got to be the right figure capable of making a real impact on that huge stage of America, whoever the then president is. I don't think we shall get a person now until after the American election.
Lord Ricketts, great to hear your thoughts. Always good to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've just posted a picture on X that you might want to take a quick look at. It shows an RAF Red Arrow jet flying low, very low, over a field towards three men who are hunched down in the grass. That Red Arrow was being flown by squadron leader Henry Prince, a founding member of the legendary aerobatic display team. Well, Henry sadly has died at the age of 90, but his legacy as a pioneer of some of the world's most incredible feats of display aviation are beyond doubt. He visited the current Red Arrow's team in March, and while he was there, he spoke to BFBS reporter Kirsty Chambers.
It certainly is nice to know that you were there at the start. We only thought it was going to last, you know, a couple of years or so.
Your son actually showed me a photo of you flying. Yeah. Can you talk me through what was going on in this photo?
The boys were sitting out on the grass, and I'd just done an air test. And they asked me when I'd done the air test if I'd give them a flyby. So I did. At that point, I'm about 6 feet off the ground. They had to duck out of the way. They've got a great sense of self-preservation. So a lot of them jumped out of the way.
Peter Roberts, honestly, look at that picture and hearing that description. I mean, we remember flybys, but one like that.
And in the days of Photoshop, photo editing, CGI and everything else, you sort of see these things, you know, in Top Gun, Maverick and other stuff. But to know that that's a real thing that happened at that height, it's a remarkable piece of piloting, right? I mean, it's huge.
Certainly.
And our attitude to risk has changed enormously. But, you know, you imagine a pilot doing that today, there'd doubtless be a court-martial that followed. But, yeah, just phenomenal. What a guy.
Well, let's bring in Jamie Gordon, sit rep producer and also presenter of the BFBS podcast, Mav Geeks. Jamie, hi. Henry Prince, he's really a legend of display flying, isn't he?
Legend is absolutely the right word. There's a couple of things to say here. One, there's a saying in aviation, there's old pilots, there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots. Now, Henry was 90 when he died, so it's a truism. The second one is, there's plenty of pilots I've spoken to who say that they're good pilots. A lot of them have to work at it, but somebody like Henry is one of those natural flyers that basically, whatever machine they fly, they are at one with it. And that to him was not dangerous or risky in any way. That was him using his ability and the machine that he was flying. Another one of those natural pilots was Ray Hanna, which Henry talked about in that interview. And together, they were the ones that formed what we now know as the Red Arrows, in terms of they brought the squadron up from 7-ship to a 9-ship formation, which meant that they could do the Diamond 9, which is their signature formation. But, you know, the Red Arrows came after a succession of squadron-based display teams, but it was only the late 60s, under the leadership of Ray Hanna and Henry, that they became the Red Arrows that we know and love today.
And you mentioned, Jamie, the kind of skill that's involved in carrying out the kind of fly pass that Henry did in that picture. But the risks taken to pioneer this kind of display flying were huge, weren't they?
They were. Again, it's different times. I mean, stick with me on the analogy here, but you remember TV programs with Fred Dibner climbing chimney stacks and John Noakes of Blue Peter climbing Nelson's Column with not a safety harness or a rope in sight. I mean, they were different times, and they flew differently then because they could. I mean, low-level flying and formation flying has always been an important part of the operational aspect of military aviation. But the Black Arrows were a squadron, Treble One squadron, who flew the Hunter. They rolled 22 Hunters in the air, and that's a world record that's never been beaten. So different times, but the skills were there and always have been.
Peter, do you remember your first time seeing the Red Arrows?
I do. I was at a Yeovilton air show way back in the early 80s. And it was a phenomenal thing to see, only matched probably by a pair of German 104 starfighters. Quite incredible. Just the feeling, the passion, the emotion that it stirs up in people is quite something.
When you see them today, I mean, we mentioned earlier how you wouldn't be allowed to do some of the things that we saw in that photograph today. Health and safety rules have evolved, understandably so. But are these pilots deliberately taking themselves to the brink, which every other pilot is told to stay as far away from as possible?
I think it's about pushing the envelope, right? And that's what, you know, everyone across the military is always told to do, is push the envelope absolutely as far as you can within certain acceptable limits. You know, you wouldn't do it using live fire ammunition or anything else. But this is teaching pilots skills. I mean, you're not going to fly in a Diamond 9 or anything else, do a crisscross in fast combat, even in dogfighting. But you are pushing yourself, your mental ability to operate. You're pushing the aircraft and finding that moment where you know it's right on the edge of its performance. It's really pushing to the edge, because when it comes to warfare and combat, that's what you're required to do. You're required to go above and beyond absolutely every time. And only by practicing that, and the Red Arrows do it at the absolute height of aviation, to be able to do that and to practice doing that is fundamental to how we train soldiers to be ready for the experience of combat.
And Peter, they are a source of national pride, but one which inevitably comes with under scrutiny when money is tight. They are, though, incredible, an incredible advert for the RAF and what it can do. It is soft power, isn't it?
Right, it is soft power. And, you know, both the Army and the Navy also had, you know, similar soft power capabilities back in the day. But gradually, they've been removed from the defence budget, because that trade-off in what you're going to buy for the expense is always something you've got to look at. So, you know, for the RAF, these internal decisions about, you know, it generates money, but is there actual cash coming into the budget? What would you do with these pilots otherwise? How would you train? Would you put more Typhoons into ACMI ranges? What would you? Those are really difficult discussions. And it might be that the RAF said, actually, we don't want these anymore. But the National Security Advisor and the Prime Minister and the Economics Department in the Treasury would all say, we need them. They're absolutely fundamental to what people think about the UK, about Britain, about its armed forces. So they add a certain amount of panache, but they also add some real-term deterrence and credibility to the functioning of our armed forces.
And Jamie, Henry Prince and his colleagues that created these stunts in planes that were not kitted out with what we would call technology today, didn't they?
I mean, Peter was talking about pushing the envelope. I mean, people like Henry actually opened it. So the NAT was so cramped that they said that you didn't get in it, but you put it on. So it was 50s tech. You've got serviceability issues. You've got trust in your colleagues to do their job. There were no sensors saying you were too low or the guy next to you is too close. It was very much you flew by eye, you flew by feel, you flew by judgment. Your hand was directly connected to the flying surfaces through links and rods from the joystick. It was really proper flying. And that's why the Hawk was instigated and taken on to follow on from the Nats, because it had exactly those qualities as well. You talk to any pilot that's flown the Hawk and they will say that's their favourite jet, because it's like a fast car.
Jamie, so good to speak to you. We'll let you get back to your mixing desk. But before we do, the new season of Mav Geeks is on the way.
I know, they've let me and Ginny loose again, and the new episode, or the first of a series of 10, will drop on the 24th of September. So looking forward to that.
Great stuff, Jamie, thanks. Now, all through the summer, we have been hearing inspiring stories from veterans sharing pivotal events in their lives and how those moments have made them. They have ranged from life-threatening floods through calls to war in the middle of the night to cycling around an airfield to practice dogfighting manoeuvres. All have been, in their own way, surprising. But our final story is perhaps the most unexpected. Andy McNab served for 8 years in the Royal Green Jackets before a decade in the SAS. After leaving the army, his book, Bravo 2-0, recounting the events of his team's capture and torture in Iraq, made him world famous. But in 1976, age 16, he could barely read or write. Then he was caught carrying out a burglary. He signed up to the Army's Infantry Junior Leaders Battalion as a route out of youth detention.
It was a year's training, and the idea was to teach you to be the future leadership, the junior and senior NCOs of the infantry. So there was about 1,100 junior soldiers there. And for the first 3 months, I hated it anyway. I thought it was worse than Borstal. Like room inspections all the time and all that marching and shouting and all that sort of stuff. And I really didn't like it. But it really took about that period of time to understand why, you know, everybody was, you know, there was like, you know, two room inspections a day. We were doing, you know, working on Saturdays up until Sunday mornings. And it was just a solid sort of year of training. And I really didn't understand it.
At what point did that change?
For me, it was the 3 month period. We all shouted out the block, you know, you have your morning inspection and all that sort of stuff. All shouted on the block in free rank. We're in the army now, so we march away. And we marched off to a different part of the camp, which was the Army Education Center. And I thought, right, the army's ripping me off again, because I've got to go back to school. So we went into these classrooms, and you're in the army now, you know, just shut up and sit there. And the world's oldest soldier came through the door. Now I know he was 40, but it was like, he's young anyway, but we're like 16, you know. So he's walking up and down looking at us, and he went over to the windows. We're right on the edge of camp. But anyway, right, that lot over there, I think you lot in here are thick as shit, but you're not. The only reason you lot can't read and write is because you don't read and write. So today that all changes. And what he then explained was that the reason we were sort of there and not flying helicopters, we were in the infantry, was that all of us had a reading and numeracy age of between 9 and 11, which is now in education policies, key stage 2. And it sort of really sort of dawned on me then that, he's right. I couldn't really truly understand what was on the page. And now, you know, I write for tabloids, I write for broadsheets, even write for the Financial Times, you know, but as a 16 coming on to 17 year old, I really couldn't even read the Sun newspaper properly. And the first book we read, all of us, was a book that was for 10-year-old primary school kids, and it was called Janet and John, Book 10. And it was a series of books, Janet and John, brother and sister, and they climbed trees and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So we all went through it during the evenings. And then on Friday evening, we all had to go and see the educator individually, read the book, read the small vocab on the back, spell the words, and explain what the words meant. And then what he said, right, close the book, which I did. And then the guy said, right, remember, you've just read a book and it didn't kill you. And I went, yes, sir. Yeah. And he said, but more importantly, remember, every single time you read something, doesn't matter what it is, poster, magazine, you know, it doesn't matter, book, doesn't matter. Every time you read something, you get a bit of knowledge. And the more knowledge you got, the more power you've got to do the things you want to do, as opposed to people telling you what to do because they got more power. Do you get that? And I went, yes, sir, which I didn't. You know, I just wanted to get out. But he was absolutely right. I sort of laid in the block. And I thought, you know what? I've just read a book. He was right. And, you know, I got a bit of knowledge about Janet and John climbing a tree. But it really didn't matter. You know what I mean? It really didn't matter. Because, and then what happened was that he knew it. I didn't know it. And none of us really knew it. But once you start reading, once you started getting that knowledge and that power, it becomes infectious. And the army had to educate people like me, not only to take information in, but to give information out, you know, if you're going to be one of these, you know, the future NCO of the army. So it not only changed my life totally, not just in the military, but certainly when I got out into, you know, to writing and now sort of, you know, producing sort of TV shows now in America, you know, it's none of that would have happened unless I'd sat in that classroom with the world's oldest soldier coming in and just explaining the facts of life and getting in the grip of us, basically.
And was it also the first time in your life that you'd actually felt valued?
Yes, very much so. I went to huge amounts of, so I went to 9 schools when I was a kid, 9 primary schools, all in South London. We sort of moved around a lot, you know, we got evicted and, you know, all that sort of stuff. And also I didn't like school anyway. So there was always this thing about like being at the bottom of society. And all of a sudden you had your bed space. And obviously it was ripped apart every morning. It was getting inspected and all that sort of stuff, but it was yours. And your responsibility, and you were paying for it. So all of a sudden, it was referred to as your bed space. It's yours. And the way that certainly the permanent staff, all the training staff, training within the platoons were sergeants, and they would always talk about the reason we do this, as opposed to the reason you're going to do it. This is what we do because you're one of us now. You know, without realizing it, emotionally, you know, you felt part of something.
So there you are. You've read your first book. You're getting a glimpse of what the potential is for yourself. Can you just tell me a bit how that changed your life going forward and what happened in the ensuing like days and weeks?
What it was all about, they're going, well, look, you can be the best soldier on the planet, but unless you get certain academic qualifications, you know, at corporal and then again at sergeant, you're not going to get promoted. So all of a sudden I think, well, I was starting to like this army business. And I thought, well, I've got to get a grip of this. I've got to get a grip of this education stuff because, you know, I want to be a corporal. I want to be a sergeant. I want to do all that sort of stuff and maybe one day become an RSM, like the educator. All of a sudden, there become this, I understood that the education was part of what you did there. And that, again, that carried on in once I got to the battalion. And even when I sort of joined the Special Air Service, the education centre in Hereford is massive, absolutely massive. But, you know, and because, you know, you learn, I don't know, you learn demolition. So you learn how to blow things up and, you know, like the films and bridges blow up and all that. It's maths that blow the bridges because you've got to work out different formulas to place the charges and the amount of explosive you're going to use, plus the shape of it. And there's set formulas that you have to learn and put them in your head. Because if you're doing sort of covert recces to blow a bridge, you know, you can't have your little Wade memoir in your top left-hand pocket. So all of a sudden, you've got to learn them. And one of the things that this educator constantly drummed into us was that you're not thick, you're just uneducated. So if you don't know something, go and ask somebody who does. They'll fall over themselves to tell you because you're taking an interest.
Yeah, and as part of that post-army career, you have written more than 50 books now. It seems incredible for someone who struggled to read a copy of The Sun at the age of 16.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's amazing. Even the very first book, Bravo 2-0, I thought, well, okay, well, I'll give it a go. And the first draft was like a patrol report, quite frankly. And then the publishers went, well, you know, this ain't good. I said, well, how do you make it better? He says, well, it's too dry. And so the publisher told me to read Joe Simpson's Touching the Void, you know, which isn't, you know, the world's biggest book, you know, about his experience, you know, climbing and the injuries that he had. And he said, if you can give that sense of place in and Jeopardy in Bravo 2.0, then it's worth publishing, because the way that Simpsons describes, you know, the ropes tangling and the ice and him falling through the ice and the injuries and all that sense of Jeopardy and Jeopardy in place is fantastic.
And perhaps less well known, since you left the military, you're also been a campaigner, including working on projects to help people in prison with their literacy. Is that about wanting others to have the same moment that you had?
Yeah, one of the biggest occupational groups in prisons are ex-military. And, you know, at one stage, everybody thought it was because of PTSD and, you know, the politics around that. But actually, it wasn't. There was a big survey that was done over 2 years. And basically, it's young men, alcohol and violence. So you got these people in prison. And again, you know, other, you know, prisoners come to these talks as well. So, and again, because they all want to know about, you know, the sass and, you know, all those, you know, say, tell the war stories, all that sort of stuff. But then say, lads, look, you've got a bit of free time here. So why don't you get your numeracy and your reading abilities up? Because then you might be able to compete when you get out. Because it's not as if you're going to walk out and everything's going to be great. You've got to be able to compete, and you've got enough sort of negative stuff coming anyway, coming out from the detention systems. So therefore, get an education, start a time to compete. Because again, you know, the overall population, the average reading ability is of an 11-year-old in the prison population. And you know, you could argue, well, it's one of the reasons why they're there, because they can't get out there and compete. I enjoy it.
And you have a particular interest in helping veterans, and your new project is called We Served. Can you just tell us a bit more about it?
Yeah. It's a system where what the people are trying to do is amalgamate all the services that veterans and serving people will need. So that's everything from, you know, what we expect of, you know, things like discounts within stores, finance and preferential banking, finance, you know, all the sort of stuff that people need in the real world. We've got cheap medical insurance for individuals and for their families, 24 access to doctors. We're signposting, obviously, the mental health facilities as well. So there's this amalgamation, a one-stop shop, but for real-life sort of situations, you know.
So when you look back at that moment, the moment that made you, what do you think the lessons are for the rest of us from what you learnt?
No one's thick about anything. It doesn't exist. You're just uneducated about it. So if you don't know it, go and find somebody who's going to show you how to do it, and you can do it. It's no one's thick. They're just uneducated. That's all. And so if you want it, you can get out there and access it.
Andy McNabb, it's been great speaking to you. Thank you so much for telling us about the moment that made you.
Thank you.
It's an incredible story, isn't it, Peter? And just a little insight there. In typical Andy McNabb style, he was sitting there in the dark in his mate's garage telling us all those very deep thoughts of his. On a serious note, though, I guess you will have seen many times in your career how the armed forces can uncover immense potential in people and realise talents they never dreamed they'd have.
Right, Kate, you're spot on. I mean, the whole thing about the military is about transforming people. I guess it's a bit like this whole episode of SITREP, right? It's been about people. It's been about individuals. And warfare is, after all, a human endeavor. Despite all the technology we talk about, it's a very human, individual thing. And the military experience, as Andy was discussing right at the start of his career, you build these incredible friendships and relationships closer than anything else than the human experience. But you learn about yourself. You deal with conflict and warfare and adversity, but you also learn some really important life skills. You are, in a way, able to be a better person because of it. And the military is really good at finding and building talent, something it doesn't often recognize within itself. It does it in a really brilliant way. So when you look around the world, you talk to other people from other militaries, and you talk about the British military, they're not jealous of the way we plan or our commanders or the way we do military procurement or anything else. They're jealous of our individuals, of our soldiers, our sailors, our aviators at the lowest possible level of our NCOs, who really are the greatest. And it's how you build those people, how you take them through adversity, how you break them down and start to build them up to give them the self-confidence to do the really difficult things like Andy does it. teaching a 16-year-old to read and learn to write. It's a phenomenal thing. And I'm almost jealous now listening to Andy talk in that little clip there. I'm jealous of starting again that military career, of all those doors opening, of all those opportunities that you're presented with. I think, you know, fantastic. Definitely the moment that made him, but also the moment that made so many people with a military career.
Professor Peter Roberts, it's been great speaking to you today. Hope to see you again soon. Thank you so much for your time. And thanks to all of our guests. Mike will be back with us for another SEPREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.